Hi, Mark.
Was geht ab, was geht ab?
Wir sind zurück, Mann. Gut, dich zu sehen.
Ja.
Woche verspätet,
Mann. Was ist los, Bro?
Woche verspätet. Wir mussten eine Woche Pause machen. Wir mussten eine Woche Urlaub machen. Ich glaube, ich ist verdient nach dem Super Bowl, nach den anstrengenden Tagen im Hype House. Aber wir sind back on track, back on schedule. Und wir haben dieses Mal ein bisschen was anderes. Wir haben unseren ersten englischsprachigen Gast heute. Das heißt, nur im Voraus, wir werden gleich ein bisschen mehr Englisch reden als üblich. Wenn Englisch für euch ein Problem ist, geht bei unserem YouTube-Channel vorbei, @wirsindgamechangers auf YouTube. Da könnt ihr die ganze Folge finden mit Subtitles, mit deutschen Untertiteln. Für alle, die nicht in Englisch flüssig sind, das ist, glaube ich, die beste Lösung. Aber ja, man, wir fucken gar nicht lange rum, gehen direkt rein.
Okay, wie Jakob gerade angesprochen hat, wir haben heute Premiere am Start, erster englisch sprechender Gast. Gleichzeitig ist es Folge 46 und herzlich willkommen zurück bei Game Changers. Sehr guter Freund von Jakob heute am Start, einer seiner Favorite-Team-Kollegen. Er spricht ständig über ihn. Hier sind ein paar Accolades über ihn und ihr werdet gleich hören, wer es ist. Er ist in Kentucky zur High School gegangen, Madison Southern, dort für über 6.700 Rushing Yards gelaufen, 122 Touchdowns Sheesh. In seiner Highschool-Karriere. Er ist dadurch ein 5-Star-Recruit geworden. Er war der Number One Running Back seiner Recruiting-Klasse, ich glaube 8. Recruit overall, was riesig ist. Ist dann zum College in Alabama gegangen, ist dort zweimal National Champion geworden, 2015 und 2017.
Two times National Champion.
In seiner Karriere bei Alabama für über 3.000 Rushing Yards gelaufen, 23 Touchdowns, wurde 2019 in der dritten Runde von den New England Patriots gedraftet. Hat in 21 seine beste NFL-Saison, 929 Rushing Yards, 15 Touchdowns, das war damals die zweitbeste zweitmeisten Touchdowns in der Liga. 2023 hat er noch eine Saison bei den Buffalo Bills gespielt. Okay.
There we go.
Und hat 2024 offiziell sein Karriereende bekannt gegeben. Es ist uns eine Ehre, ihn willkommen zu heißen. Wir switchen jetzt auf Englisch rüber. Damien Harris, it's an honor. Appreciate you being here.
Yeah. Come on, give me these flowers, man. Give me these flowers.
Yeah. Glad to have you here, man.
How you feeling?
Life is good. Life has been good. Now I'm transitioning. Yak, you know that. You know, I work as a TV commentator now. I get to be an analyst and break down football and just, you know, continue to be a part of the game. So got a beautiful family, wonderful wife, wonderful son, beautiful home. I mean, life is just, you know, it's crazy because I work so hard and obviously I got a lot of life left. I'm going to be working hard for a long time. But, you know, I work so hard at such a young age that I get to start to enjoy the fruit of my labor at a young age. I'm only 28 years old. You know, I just turned 28, but all the hard work I put in, you know, from the age 8 until now, you know, I'm finally starting to settle into all the good times and just, you know, all that, the peace that people talk about. You know, whenever you work so hard and you finally accomplish a lot of things, you know, it's not necessarily the trophies, it's not necessarily the accolades or the money that are become important to you, but it's more so just the peace that you have, the ability to sit around and be thankful for all the things that you did and, you know, all the opportunities you had, all the great people you got to meet. So, man, I got a couple national championship rings on and, you know, I'm just enjoying life, man. Glad to be on Game Changers podcast.
Hey, man, that's dope. Let's talk about some of that hard work, right? Like we talked about it earlier. Mark was not a highly recruited guy necessarily. I wasn't a highly recruited guy Mark, I drafted 7th round. I'm probably below a free agent, right? International pathway guy. You went a little bit of different route, right? I would say more the classical journey of being a high school phenom to being a college superstar to then getting drafted in the NFL. Where did your journey with football start?
So my journey with football started in Richmond, Kentucky. That's where I was born and raised. I started playing football at the age of 8. And, you know, it's a lot different than times now, right?
Because first of all, 8 is crazy.
Right. And I was going to say it was tackle at 8 years old. Yeah. Like a lot of people nowadays have their kids in like flag football, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I had the pads on the first time I ever stepped on a field. And to be honest with you, I hated it. I hated football. I hated the helmet, the way that you remember those old ear pads that would like, button in and unbutton, like. I hated those. I hated getting dirty and everything. And it was miserable. So I sat on the bench as much as I could. I drank as much water as my body would hold. I remember there was one game where we actually had to travel pretty far to play. And it was cold. It was rainy. It had to be like 9 o'clock in the morning. And I remember I was sitting on the bench and my mom came out of the stands and she sat down beside me. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, we're about to have like a nice little friendly conversation. And she tells me, if you don't get your ass out there, whenever you get home, you're going to be in trouble because you're basically quitting something. You started something and now you're not participating. You're ready to quit. You're not being a part of the team. And so obviously, knowing what kind of trouble I was going to get in when I got home, I didn't really want no parts of that. So, shoot, I got my ass out there and I started playing and, you know, somehow, some way ended up scoring the game-winning touchdown of that exact game. And then that was my mom's first, you know, lesson in action that showed me whenever you sign up for something, whenever you work hard for something, good things will come. It'll be when you don't expect it. It can be when you can expect it. But one thing that you can count on is when you start something and you put all your effort into it, by the time you're finished, you are going to feel successful. You are going to feel like you finished what you started and you'll have a sense of pride about it. So that's how I got started. And then obviously, you know, through Little League, like I was just the biggest, fastest, strongest kid out there. I mean, I look like Reggie Bush out there. If you saw my old Little League highlights, man, I look like Reggie Bush out there. But, you know, I just continue to elevate. I continue to work on my craft and continue to take it seriously because, you know, I always had that same thought of, you know, even when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, back to that time when my mom sat down beside me and talked about me quitting, right? So I just kept putting in all the work and, you know, I kept rising through the ranks. Obviously, I went to a bunch of combines. I went to a bunch of camps. I did a bunch of visits at universities. And then obviously they started offering me, which was really, really cool, right? But, you know, something that me and Mark had kind of talked about before we hopped on is like the pressure of that, right? Like everybody thinks that it's this glamorous lifestyle. Like, you know, you're a high school kid and every time you go to a college campus, you're flocked by undergrad girls and cheerleaders and stuff. And don't get me wrong, that part was really, really cool, right? But then imagine having like Nick Saban, Urban Meyer, Dabo Sweeney, the Lane Kiffins, like all the top coaches in college football.
Like the biggest names in coaching.
The biggest names. They're beating down your door and they're all giving you a pitch as to why you should come here, right? So I thought of it a little bit differently than most people, I feel like, because I don't like letting anybody down. Like, obviously, I'm a self-pleaser. I do everything for my own greater good and for the greater good of my family, but I hate disappointing people. So, you know, I thought about, well, if I go to Alabama, I'm going to have to tell Urban Meyer no.
Right.
And, like, if he needs a running back, that might or another perfect example, you know, I was highly recruited by the University of Kentucky and they were in a big rebuilding phase. And the head coach, you know, he was at my signing. A bunch of UK football players were at my signing because they all thought that I was going to go to Kentucky. But then I picked Alabama and then just seeing the look on their faces, the look of disappointment, the look of, man, I thought you were one of us. And like, that's a part of the process. That's a part of the journey that people don't really understand.
Well, it's real uncomfortable. Let me just link in right there. You're from Kentucky. The University of Kentucky is like, what, maybe 30 minutes or something from where you grew up?
25, maybe. Damn,
yeah, so of course, they're there. They're expecting, yo, this the local kid. He's going to come sign at the University of Kentucky, and we're rolling from here. And to then, in their face, after they're there in the room with you, choosing a different university, that's a lot of pressure to put on a How old were you then? 16, 17?
I was 17 years old. And, you know, like you said, it's a ton of pressure. Like, obviously, there's a ton of upside. There's a lot of opportunity on the other side of that door. But when you're picking which door, multiple doors stay closed when you open one. And again, there's going to be people on the other side of that door that aren't happy with the decisions that you make. Like, Yak, to your point, obviously, me being from Kentucky and then not going to the University of Kentucky, I'll never forget this. It was a pastor, or I don't know if this is a real person or not, but it was a Twitter account by the name of Pastor Alan Jones. And this was back in 2014, so I was 17 years old. Right after I committed to Alabama, he tweeted, he tagged me, and he's like, "I hope you break your leg and have a career-ending injury and can never play football again."
Damn.
Wow.
So talk about pressure, right? Oh, talk about not winning.
And that's a pastor. Right. You know what I mean? That's somebody you might be able to put in a word with the guy up there.
Yeah, that wasn't Kentucky's number one football fan. That was a man of God right there. So, you know, there was a lot of pressure. But again, I think that lesson that my mom taught me sitting there on the bench of, okay, well, I committed to Alabama. I've started something regardless of all the circumstances. I have to finish it. So I just approach every single day just like that. Like, I can't quit now. I can't back out. No matter how hard the day's got, no matter how many 110s in 120 degree weather we had to run at Alabama, like, no matter how hard Nick Saban made it, I never had the mentality to quit, to fold, to back down from any challenge. Because again, my mind was thinking back to, shoot, if I quit, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna probably get in trouble with my mom if I quit, you know? So I just kept grinding and just kept working. And obviously I was able to have a pretty successful college career. Also, I should note that, Mark, I don't know if Yak has told you this, and for all my German fans and listeners out there, the University of Tennessee never beat the University of Alabama when I was
here.
Mark,
I give him shit all the time.
Let me tell you this, Mark. My senior year, this is how bad Tennessee was when I was there. My senior year, I actually got in trouble with Coach Saban because I was late to a meeting. And this was back in the Alabama days where they actually made people take accountability for their mistakes. But I was late to a meeting.
Yeah, for sure.
Nick Saban, he comes and tells me, he's like, "Hey, listen, I'm really disappointed that you were late, but I'm even more disappointed in the fact that you didn't come and talk to me about the fact that you were late. Own up to your mistakes and take accountability. So what we're going to do is, you're having a great season. We're not really worried about Tennessee. So we're going to sit you for this
whole
game.
Damn,
like that.
You're going to
be suspended." Like, suspended me for the whole game, right? And so I'm sitting here like, and of course, we beating the shit out of Tennessee. So I'm sitting here like, dang, man.
I wish I could
have a piece of that pie right there, man. That pie looked good. And then it's the fourth quarter. It's like, I want to say maybe 10 minutes left in the fourth quarter. We were beating them so bad that we started putting our backups in. And then Coach Saban looked at me, and I had my pads on. He was like, "You know what, David, just go ahead. Go ahead and get out there, get you a few reps, you know, stay fresh. We're going to need you next week. Go ahead." First play I was in the game, I scored a touchdown. I kid you not. So I was in this. Tennessee could never
mess with us. Hold on. Yeah, you were on the team during that time, right?
I was on the team during those days, yes. Yeah. And getting ready to
talk
play.
About that, what was your recollection of that game?
I don't particularly remember this exact game, right? I will say this. I played against Alabama four times in my career at Tennessee. The closest we've got was, I want to say, my sophomore year at Alabama. We ended up losing by four. Derrick Henry broke a run late in the fourth to seal the game. Our kicker missed, I want to say, three field goals in that game, just because that Bryant Denny Stadium is no joke. Like, it's loud. You talk about pressure. That was probably a little bit too much for our guy Aaron Medley. But all the other times, it wasn't even close. It wasn't even close. The first play, like, I played linebacker my freshman year. The first play Alabama had in our game my freshman year was a 5-yard under route to Amari Cooper that he took to the house. That was the first play of the game. Like, we had some of our best guys. I'm not gonna name no names. We had some of our best guys sit out Alabama games with phantom injuries, not to fuck up their draft film. You know what I mean? Like, it was
like that.
Getting ready to play Alabama during those days was no
we
joke.
Was like that,
it was
Mark. We was like
it
that.
Was different, you know. But listen, before we keep glazing the roll tide people right here, right? I want to take it a few steps back. Your transition from high school to college, right? What do you credit with your development, like as a player? Would you say it was all talent? It was more the work that you put in. How, or if you had to put a percentage on it, how much talent, how much hard work would you assign to your development as a player?
To be honest, I'd probably call it a 75-25 split. 75% of it was due to just my natural God-given ability. And 25%, I would say, was due to the hard work. Now, when I say that, I want to be very mindful of my words here. It wasn't the fact that I only put in 25% of effort to work. One, I was just way more gifted than a lot of people in my area at that time, at that age. But what I was fortunate to have was the experiences of going to rivals camps, going to Under Armour camps, you know, going to these schools like Ohio State, like Alabama, and competing with other kids that were my age that had the same level of God-given talent and God-given ability across, and they were all across the country. So I got to take a real good look at the people that I was truly competing with. Like, I wasn't just competing with kids in the state of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I was competing with kids across the country, right?
Facts.
So then that 25%, you know, that was 100% max effort. Like, I was lifting weights. I remember I took a PE 4 class my last period of high school. Last class every year of high school, because PE4 was in the football weight room. So I would just be in there breaking down film. And like, if I could go steal some extra time on the field with coaches and, you know, do individual things that would help me improve my craft, I would be out there doing it. So like, as far as being locked in from like a hard work standpoint, or like a preparing myself to compete against those other kids, like, I was doing everything that I could. That's why I would give it that 75-25 split, just because, again, I was more talented than a lot of kids that I was competing against.
But you also put the work in.
Yeah, facts. But I also put the work in. And then that work that I put in, talking about the transition from high school to college, that work benefited me so much. And not in my freshman year, because I didn't play at all my freshman year. Like, Yak said, we had Derrick Henry. He won the Heisman Trophy that year. We won the national championship. You know, he broke almost every record for rushing. Like, he was the man. He did it all. So I saw no reps my freshman year. But all that hard work that I put in middle school and high school, what it prepared me for was that next season when Derrick Henry was gone. Like, I didn't get lost in the fact of, oh, well, I came to Alabama thinking I was going to be a starter and I wasn't. Or, oh, I'm now a small fish in a big pond. I was like, it's just time to go back to work. Again, that moment with my mother sitting on the bench, it just came back to me. I was like, listen, it's just time to go to work. It's time to get back to being at the top when it comes to putting in effort to where I want to go.
Do you mind taking us back to, like, what went into the decision of taking Bama over any other school in the country, right? I mean, obviously, as a five-star recruit, you go wherever you want. You talked about, you named some of those coaches. Mm-hmm. What was it about Nick Saban and University of Alabama that made you decide to go there?
Well, you know what's funny, Mark, is the day that I made my decision and made my announcement, I did like the typical high school gymnasium. Mm-hmm. You know, all the kids came in. I had three hats on the table. One was Ohio State. One was Kentucky. One was Alabama.
So who are those coaches?
And
So
at Kentucky, it was Mark Stoops. Yep. At Ohio State, it was Urban Meyer. Right. And then at Alabama, it was obviously Nick Saban. So the gymnasium is starting to fill up. All the kids, teachers, all the faculty, staff starts coming into the gym. I'm sitting up there with my high school coach and my mom. And my mom was like, hey, you still haven't told me where you're going to college.
Way.
Like, you still haven't told me yet. Wow. And at that time,
did you know?
I hadn't really made a decision yet. I was just like, And so I looked at my mom and I told her, I was like, listen, I'm going to stay home. I'm going to go to the University of Kentucky. I'm going to be close to my family. Like, I had a high school girlfriend at the
time. Hold on. That was minutes before making the decision.
Minutes.
Oh, that's good.
Like, not even 10 minutes, maybe 5, right?
And you were taking visits everywhere, I'm assuming?
Yeah. So okay. I had taken my visits. So those are my three final schools. So I did officials at all three of those schools. The other ones, I didn't really want to waste time. So we're sitting there. They're playing highlights, you know, people are talking, my coaches are talking, everything. And then finally they hand me the microphone and they're like, all right, it's your time now. Like, you say whatever you want, do whatever you want, like, the floor is yours. And so I started talking, you know, I started thanking people who helped me, you know, get there. I thank the schools that recruited me for giving me the opportunity and blah, blah, blah. And then I went on to say, and, you know, for the next 4 years, I will be attending the University of And I reached for that Kentucky hat, and I swear to God, at a moment's notice, I just switched my hand, picked up the Alabama hat, put it on, said, I'm going to the University of Alabama. And then it was history. Damn, the rest of it is history. Now, people have asked me a lot, right? Like, I've told that story a lot of times, and not everybody believes me. I swear to God, it's 100% true. That's part of the reason why I'm sure Kentucky's head coach and a lot of their players were there, because they probably had a good feeling that I was going to end up going there as well. So just so you know, I'm not. This is not made up. This is not fabricated. People ask me what went into that last minute decision, what went into me changing directions at the last second. I have no idea. I was not in control in that moment. I feel like the greater powers, whatever you believe in, I believe in my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I feel like in that moment, he guided my steps. He guided my hand. He guided my heart, my mind, my soul, and my body. And he knew what was best for me. He knew that going to the University of Kentucky was not going to be best for me. He knew that staying home and being close to certain people and certain groups of people that, you know, I had grown so close to and certain environments that I'd been in for most of my life, he knew that those situations were not right for me. Maybe at the moment they would have been, but to help me get to where I am now, I don't think I would have gotten there if I would have gone to Kentucky. And that's why, you know, the Lord came over me and allowed me to make that decision. Now, in hindsight, it's very easy to say why I went to Alabama, because I wanted to compete at the highest level. And what I say by that is it's not just to play teams like Tennessee or Georgia or Florida. Like, Mark, we had the best players on offense. We had the best players on defense. Right. We had the best players on special teams.
Alabama was a machine at that time.
It was a machine. So it wasn't even like I went to Alabama to compete against the best on Saturdays. I went to Alabama to compete against the best on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. Those were the people that I were competing against, because the level of talent that we had, and not just the level of talent, the level of hard workers, like guys like Minka Fitzpatrick, guys like Reuben Foster, guys like Marlon Humphrey, hell, even Derrick Henry. Like, Derrick Henry showed me the way to take my training to another level, take my hard work to another level. But again, like, we were competing with each other because we knew that simply we were the best. Not only did we want to be the best, we wanted to be the best on that roster. So obviously, I wasn't better than Derrick Henry when he was there, but I wanted to be better than him. And there were other guys that I played with that wanted to be just as good, if not better than me. So all of those things, I knew that Coach Saban was going to, you know, help me understand what it was like to be a professional, even at the college level, because he had spent time in the NFL. Right. And I knew I was going to be able to compete for national championships. Like, obviously, that had to have been, you know, on my subconscious, that had to be on the Lord's, you know, plan for me, or else, you know, I wouldn't have accomplished those things. But, you know,
it kind of tracks with what you said about going to these different camps all across the country, seeing the kids you're really competing with, right? If you want to be a lead running back, and then choosing the school who had the most elite group of guys to compete against. I think that's something that people might miss, right? Going to the SEC is one thing. Like, on Sunday, you'll play against the best. But if you were part of Alabama during that time, every day you're in a room with the top players at that position, at your position, at running back. At practice, you're seeing the top linebackers in the country. You're seeing the top defensive line in the country. And that's how you get better at the end of the day, through competition. Yeah. That's the only way.
Mark, you want to hear something funny?
Talk to me.
So when you introed me so beautifully, you mentioned that I was drafted in the third round. I had two backups when I was in college. And you know what rounds they got drafted in?
First?
They both got drafted in the first round.
Who were they?
Wow.
Josh Jacobs and Najee Harris. So that's crazy. That's even more of a symbol of how competitive it was, right? And how
crazy.
Me being there brought out the absolute most and the absolute best in me. And, you know, the message behind all of that, I guess the message for me that I'm, you know, trying to share with you guys and whoever's going to be listening is, don't be afraid of the work. Don't run from the work. The work. Yeah, I know you've heard this, Mark. I'm sure you've heard this as well, but it's not about the destination. It's not about where you're trying to get to. It's about the journey that you go through, the changes, the elevation. Sometimes you're up here, sometimes you go through here. But at the end of the day, you still have to have that same goal and objective in mind and just be ready to work no matter what the circumstances are. When things are good, you've still got to work to keep things good. When things aren't so good, you've got to work to make things better. When you think things are at the absolute best they can be, I guarantee you, if you keep working, you're going to see that there's a level even above that above you still that. Haven't even reached yet. It's all about being consistent day in and day out and bringing the right lunch pail to work with you. Bring the pail that is going to help you work the best. Your mentality, your attitude, your level of focus, your commitment to being your absolute best, that is your lunch pail, and that is what is going to elevate you through life, through jobs, through sport, whatever it is that you want to do. But you have to maintain the desire to want to work.
Man, that's good.
That's real.
Man, that's good.
That's real. That's how you get two national championship
rings. That's what I'm talking about, bro.
All right, that's
for real, though.
Not one, but two, but, man.
Bro, real quick.
Go ahead, Mark.
No, just like your mindset, like, you know, stepping on campus, you a freshman in Alabama. Okay, you five-star recruit. Like, talk to us. Like, what were your expectations? Did you think, okay, I know I have Derrick Henry right in front of me. Am I going to play? How did you deal with not playing eventually? Like just, you know, take us into that a little bit.
Yeah, so when I first came in, like, I knew Derrick was Derrick, and I knew he was going to have a special year. I knew he was more than likely going to be the starter, but I thought that I was going to be splitting a lot of time with him. I thought he was going to be like 1A, and I was going to be 1B.
Right.
But then I forgot we had a senior by the name of Kenyon Drake, who was a really, really good, really good football player. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. He was fast as hell. He could catch the ball out of the backfield. We had some other guys in the running back room that just made it really hard. So, you know, the mentality that I had of, okay, I'm going to come in and play a lot, to realizing, oh, shit, no, I'm not. It definitely hit me hard. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to sit here and pretend as if, you know, I was just smiling through it all. And, you know, I didn't feel a sense of disappointment. I was absolutely disappointed. And I allowed myself to be disappointed. I'm not one of those people that if I feel a certain emotion, especially a negative one, like disappointment, like, you know, fear of not stepping on the field or things like that, like, I kind of let those sit with me for a second, because it's a feeling that I want to remember and a feeling that I never want to have to go through again. Mm. So I let myself be disappointed. Like, I wasn't one of those guys who was just like, you know what, screw it, I'm just going to transfer, or screw it, like, I'm not good enough. I was just like, wow, man, I'm really disappointed. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sit here and be disappointed for a second, because unless Derrick gets hurt, which, you know, he's a machine, and knock on wood, he hasn't gotten hurt throughout his entire career. Unless he had gotten hurt, unless something had happened to some other guys, like, I didn't see a real chance of playing. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to stay locked in the meetings. I'm going to stay locked in practice. I'm going to be locked in on the sidelines in case I have to go in. But in everything that I do, I am going to feel a little disappointed, just because, again, I don't want to ever feel this way again. And I'm going to use this feeling to fuel me in everything that I do, every step that I take, every rep that I do. This feeling is going to fuel me. And it did. Like I said, once the season ended my freshman year, and once, you know, Derrick Henry declared for the draft, that was the moment where I was like, okay, I've spent the last 3-4 months feeling nothing but disappointment, a little bit of shame, a little bit of anger, a little bit of frustration. Now it's time to turn that into something positive. Now it's time to use that to get me to where I want to go. People are so often confused that setbacks, that failures, that disappointment keeps you from where you want to go. I disagree. If anything, if you use it the right way, if you have the right mentality, if you're hardwired the right way between here, it can get you even closer to your goals than success can. Because again, it gives you that sense and that feeling of something that you never want to be a part of again, something that you never want to experience again. And then it's nothing but a springboard to push you forward. I almost describe it like this, right? You know what happens when you take a bow and arrow and then you pull the arrow further and further and further and further back? Whenever you let it go, the further it flies. That's how I live my life. That's the mentality that I have. Anytime something discourages me or disappoints me, or I feel like it's bringing me a step back, I always think, man, this arrow is going to go even further because of how far life is pulling me back right now.
That's real. Man, that's real. Do you feel like that's something in the new college environment, right? Like, back when we were in college, things were a little bit different. There was no transferring. There was no getting out of the situation, right? You had to see it through. You had to figure out a way. Do you feel like there's something that's being lost with the way that the game is changing with the transfer portal and the NIL money?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, you're losing your sense of loyalty, which is not just loyalty to the program, but loyal to the fans, because that's what makes college football so much better than the NFL. That's what makes college football better than a lot of other sports, is the outpour of support that you get from fans, that you get from boosters, that you get from people who just love the university that you go to. Like, Yach, you know, if you're in California and you see somebody with a Tennessee orange shirt on, you're going to say, go Vols.
Go Vols. Just like
if I see somebody in Europe and they're wearing an Alabama shirt, I'm going to say Roll Tide. They're going to say it right back, right? So you're losing that connection and that tie and that brand of loyalty that has kept college football intact for so long. One thing that you're also doing is you're teaching kids that microwave success is the recipe for getting to where you want to go. So if you don't like the situation that you're in now, okay, well, guess what? I'm just going to get up and go somewhere else where I think the grass is a little bit greener. Mm-hmm. Or you're at a program that you really like, but another team come and offers you a better NIL package, and you're like, well, the money's better over there. The opportunity might not be as good. The coaching, the team, the chemistry, the locker room might not be as good, but shoot, I want that money right now. What did I just talk about with that arrow? Pull it back whenever you have to go through something, whenever you, whether it's times of, okay, our team isn't really good right now. Perfect example. Yach, the running back from Arizona State, Cam Scataboo. He was a guy who was there when Arizona State had sanctions. He was there when they had the death penalty. He was there when they couldn't recruit. They couldn't go to bowl games. They couldn't do anything. He didn't just get up and leave once they opened the transfer portal. He didn't just get up and leave because, you know, another opportunity, another school was offering him more NIL money. He stayed at Arizona State. They won the Big 12. They got to the college football playoff, and they almost beat Texas. Like, they were a couple plays away, but the whole program has shifted. The whole culture for Arizona State has shifted. Cam Scataboo is so glad that he stayed and did not go somewhere else, because look at the foundation that he's set for the future Sun Devils. Look at how he's etched his name at the program. That's not something that you see a lot anymore. Even a guy like Ashton Jeanty, another running back from Boise State.
Right.
People ask him all the time, why did you not go to a better school so you could have gotten more respect? Why didn't you go here to get more money? I wanted to stay at Boise State so I could create a legacy that would never be torn down, that you couldn't say, oh, well, I just left for this, or I just went and did that. Like, we aren't teaching the kids fundamentals of what makes success. Look at the great Tom Brady. Yach, you played with him. I played with him. We all saw what he was at the end of his career. You know, we always talk about Tom Brady, you know, from a certain point on, but there was a rookie year where he didn't play.
Yeah.
Drew Bledsoe was the guy. And so
he had to sit back and
yeah, he just let the arrow get pulled back further and further. But now look at him now. And you think if Tom Brady had just, let's say hypothetically, if he had walked into Bill Belichick's office and said, you know what, I want out. And let's say Bill granted him a trade and traded him somewhere else. You think we'd still be talking about Tom Brady in the same breath?
Absolutely not.
And in all of this, what's the main problem here? Where do these kids want to get to? These kids want to get to the NFL. The way they're doing things in college is nothing like how they do it in the NFL. People always want to talk about, oh, well, college football is becoming like the NFL. No, it's not. You know why? Because if you're unhappy, you can't just get up and go in the general manager's office and request a trade and expect to be able to go wherever you want with no punishment or with no liability.
Facts.
There's a rule. They're trying to create a rule now to where if schools in the state of Alabama and Georgia, the kids who receive NIL money don't have to pay income taxes on it.
What?
That's exactly right. It's horrible, right? Yeah.
I see what they're trying to do, though. They want to be able to compete with the schools up north.
Exactly.
Schools down south don't have as much money, but we can offer you a better tax rate so you'll keep more money in your pocket. That's nasty, man. That's nasty.
You know, and I compare it to this. Why do you guys think that teams like the Houston Texans, the Dallas Cowboys, the Jacksonville Jaguars, the Miami Dolphins, you know, all these teams, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers is another example. Why do they not win the Super Bowl every single year? Well, I'll tell you why. It's because free agents don't just say, oh, well, if I go to a team in Florida or, oh, if I go to a team in Texas, I'm not going to have to pay any state income taxes. So all the best players are just going to go to Florida or Texas. It doesn't work that way. So you're giving these kids, again, a bunch of meaningless tools that they cannot put in their toolbox and use to be professionals at what they're doing. Like right now, they're still amateurs. But once you get to the professional level, there's rules and regulations. There's codes of conduct, of ethics, and things that you just cannot do. Yeah. And they're creating that. They've opened that door in college football. So now, once this new wave of college football players get to the NFL, then they're really going to have a problem. Because then these kids who come in as rookies and first round picks who aren't playing, they're going to go in these offices and demand trades. You can't do that. Caleb Williams.
Damon, they will go an elevator level higher, and they'll go to the owner and be like, bro, get rid of the coach.
I don't like
this coach.
Point blank, period. Give me a different coach. Give me a different coach. Give me this. Give me that. Hell, I heard reports of Caleb Williams whenever he was going through the draft process. Like, obviously, he was going to be the number one pick, but he went to the Bears and told them he wanted a certain amount of his salary to be paid either in crypto or in some type of way to where it couldn't be taxed. They said no. He came in also asking for a percentage, ownership percentage of the Chicago Bears. You can't do that. Like, again, and that was Caleb Williams, who just came out of college a couple of years ago. And he was on the tail end of players like me and Yak, who didn't necessarily get all of these benefits, but he got them just a little bit. And now he's asking for ownership percentages in the team that drafts him. So, again, whenever I talk about all these things and like the direction that the game is taking, you know, people always want to argue, is it good for viewership? Is it good for the fans? Is it good for the business? Possibly. I'm not going to sit here and say that it's not. But what I am going to say is we are absolutely putting these kids at a disadvantage for whenever they get to the professional level. Because, again, like I said, there are rules and regulations, codes of conduct, ethics, all kinds of things that you just can't do once you get to that level. And these kids aren't going to be able to handle it.
Yeah, I think it's I will never knock a guy for going somewhere where he can get more money, right? But it's kind of for the adults in the room to set up a framework where that just can't happen. Because another thing that I heard today, I'm training with a bunch of young guys who are getting ready for the draft. And apparently a thing that's happening now is schools will offer big money to guys that are about to commit to one of their in-conference rivals, even if they have no use for this player, essentially, just to keep him off the roster over there. Then bringing a guy on your team that you're going to sit on the bench, he's not going to touch the field, he's essentially just pocketing the money, but he's setting himself back because he doesn't get to play, you know what I mean? But you weakened your competition because he's not on the roster over there. And that, you know what I mean? Those type of, that's nasty.
These kids, man, you know what I'm saying?
It's such a disservice to the kids. And that's what the game is about. Like, listen, I understand that the NCAA is an organization. I understand that all the games that they show on TV, at the end of the day, it is TV, it is entertainment. Right. But I say this as somebody who has played the game and somebody who loves the game with all my heart. The game is about the players. The game is about the people who put on the pads, suit up for battle with their brothers, and go out there and compete damn near to the death to win a football game. So the reason why I speak so passionately, and I don't want to say negatively, but again, just passionately about it, is because I care about these kids. I care about their futures. I care about how we as adults, as you know, the people who they were like, okay, yeah, Damian Harris, he went to Alabama, he played in the NFL. Jakob Johnson, he made it from the International Pathway Program. He got he signed with the Patriots. He had a great career, yada, yada, yada. Like, we are the examples. But I hate when I sit around and see all of these peoples and a lot of people who haven't even played the game sit there and create these rules and create these structures and these formats and allow them to do things that is doing nothing but setting them back. It's like you take two steps forward to take 10 steps back with these kids. And it raises my blood pressure a little bit. Just because, again, I care about these kids. I care about the brand, the game of football. Like, I care too much to watch it and just be like, oh, well, it's good for viewership. It's good for TV content. So, you know, by any means, just go ahead and do it. Like, I don't work that way.
Yeah, that's real. Well, let's transition a little bit, I'd say, from the college game to the pros, man. Like, you ended up getting drafted to the New England Patriots. What was your draft experience like? Did you have like a bunch of teams that you were kind of like, you didn't know where you're going to end up, or was it pretty clear from the jump?
Talk to me about position too, because you know, you mentioned third round, then you had your backups going first. Like, just like in hindsight, man, talk to me about your feelings.
I will say Josh Jacobs was my backup, and he got drafted in the first round of the same draft that I was in.
What?
So, yeah.
Oh,
so,
I didn't realize that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we were drafted in the same class, and he was drafted in the first round. It was like the 20 something pick by the Raiders, obviously.
Okay, that must have made you feel something a certain way. Yeah, I mean, obviously y'all boys and all that, but
it did.
Yeah.
No, for sure. I mean, Josh has always been my boy. Like, we were roommates. Right. He was kind of like my younger brother. Like, we were always together.
Mark, these guys have the same birthday, actually.
Yeah, we even have the same birthday.
Like, same age too. Yeah.
So like he's a year younger. I got you. He's a year younger than me, but same birthday. Like, we were homeboys, but it definitely hurt my soul a little bit. Nothing to do with Josh.
No,
running back had drafted in the first round, like that shit. Whatever.
What was the knock on you? Then, what was the draft grade? Like, kind of like the overall consensus on you while it dropped to third?
I think that I was like Mr. Reliable, Mr. Dependable, Mr. like whatever you need, like he can do it. But I think that they thought my floor or my ceiling was a little bit lower than somebody like Josh, as they thought he might have been more explosive. They thought he might have had bigger play ability, because I was that guy that was like, I averaged probably, I actually set the record at Alabama. I averaged 7.4 yards a carry, right?
Wow.
And so, but it was just like, it was a very consistent 7 yards. It was like 7, 7, 7, 7. Now, granted, I definitely went through my fair share of big plays. Like, I had a couple 75 yarders, a couple 80 yarders. One thing that was a huge knock on me, I will say, is the fact that from my sophomore year and my senior year, I got ran down a lot. Like, I probably could have had the record for most 80, 70 yard touchdowns, but it's like I was always getting caught at the 1 yard line. Like, I remember, you know who Adoree Jackson is.
Right.
He's a track star. Like, this dude, it was like almost an Olympian track runner. He played defensive back for USC. So my sophomore year, I had two long breakaway runs. Both would have been 70 plus yard touchdowns. And he ran me down both times. And like, then that became a habit. Like, okay, he can get you the big play, but can he finish? Can he get all the way to the end zone? And then another problem I had was on those plays where I would get us down to the 1 yard line, we had a bigger back named Bo Scarborough, who was pretty much the same size as Derrick Henry and had, you know, a shit ton of ability. And so whenever we would get to the one, they would put him in because it was like a surefire touchdown. So it was like, okay, well, he can't hit his head on the goalpost. Then they take him out to put somebody else in from 1 yard. So it's like, well, what do you really get with this guy? Like, yeah, he's great from 20 to 20, but you know, other than that, what has he really got? They didn't ask me to catch a lot of passes out of the backfield. So, you know, I think that was a big question mark. Not a concern, but just like, can't do it? Because we haven't seen him have to.
But that's one of those things where they start nitpicking you for doing your job in the system, right? Alabama had you be the guy that carries them, gets them the 7 yards, gets them down to the 1 yard line. But you being a good teammate almost is then getting punished by the draft analysts in their their great wisdom of like, he can't do this, he can't do that just because you didn't show it on
tape. That was, you know, that was something else that happened my senior year, because, you know, by my senior year, I developed a reputation as one of the better backs in the SEC, maybe the best back in the SEC. Like, going in that senior year, there was a lot of hype around my name, right? But what we would do is we would have a wildcat package where Josh would be the quarterback. He would take the direct snap, and then he would either run like a zone read with me, where most of the time he would keep it because the end would crash, or I would just be kind of like a decoy and I would like slide through the flat. And a lot of times in short yardage, they would, you know, the ball would go to Josh. And then I remember it might have been the Ravens. I was doing a draft meeting with the Ravens, and we were looking at some film, and they asked me straight up. They were like, well, why is it that every time it's third and one or fourth and one or third and goal from the 1 yard line, they use this other guy? I was like, I don't know. Like, it's just play calling. It's just me doing my job. Like, I'm blocking for my teammate. I'm trying to do my 111 and make sure the play is successful. But like, that proves Yak's point. Like, you are put in a system and you do your job. You do your job well. But then they start nitpicking and be like, okay, well, you were asked to do this, but why didn't they ask you to do that?
Right.
I don't fucking know. Like, I'm not the coach. I don't call the plays. But, you know, the draft process, it was definitely tedious. The combine is like the worst thing in sports. Facts. Like, yeah. I know that people get super excited to be invited, but it's like three or four days of just like hell on earth. Like, you got to do meeting after meeting, interview after interview.
How many did you have? Do you remember?
You talk to some. I don't remember. I want to say maybe somewhere between 4 and 6.
Yeah, and those, yeah, bro, they grind you.
Yeah, and they're the worst, dude. So picture this: you go through this for 3 or 4 days, and on the very last day that you're there, then you got to go and compete. Then you got to go and run. And then by this time, you're already ready to leave the combine. You're like, man, fuck this. Like, I'm ready to go. Like, I'm ready to get back to my family. I'm ready to get back to training. Whatever, right? But then you got to go and perform. And for some people, it works out well. For some people, it doesn't. Right. I had a pretty decent day. Like, I ran a 4.49. Then I ran a 4.5. I had a 37-inch vert. Nice. I had like a 10.3 broad jump. So, like, I put up some pretty good numbers and, you know, had a day. But other than that, like I said, it was a pretty interesting process because, you know, I started to get some word. And this is just 100% transparency. This is me being absolutely honest. I was in a relationship in college that was very, let's just say it wasn't the right relationship. Mm. And it was never like a thing where like anybody ever had to get involved or like people were concerned for my safety, my ex-girlfriend's safety. People just knew that we were really young and that we were like, I was doing some stuff that I shouldn't have been doing while having a girlfriend. And rightfully so, she was getting pretty upset about it. So, I mean, it was as simple as that. But, you know, towards the end of the draft process, I started to get some word from like my agent that some of that stuff had started to leak to some of the teams, some of the GMs and stuff like that. Damn. I was like, yo, damn, like, this is weird because it's coming from people at Alabama, because how else would they know? And I'm like, damn, like, this is supposed to be my people. Like, y'all supposed to have my back and y'all are outing me like that. And that was a very young thought process of me to have. Now that I'm 28 years old, now that I've spent time in the NFL, I see the way the business operates. They find out anything and everything. Facts. If it's on your record, good, bad, or ugly, they will find it. So
they'll speak to everybody. They will interview people and they have the relationships.
Little league coaches. Right. They talk to, you know, your pediatrician as a child. Like, they talk to everybody. So I don't have any more vaccinations. Exactly. Like, I don't have any more hard feelings towards the people of Alabama for that. But, you know, I heard that started to get out. So I got a little nervous and, you know, I felt like I wasn't, like, even though I thought I could be a first round pick, I thought that I just wasn't getting that buzz. I wasn't getting that hype. I wasn't getting that like notoriety. So, you know, towards the end, a little bit before the draft, that's when I started to prepare myself. Like, okay, I'm probably not going to be a day one pick. That's going to be all right, though. Like, I'm still going to be probably an early day two pick at the latest, and like, everything will be fine. Right. So then day two happens and the whole second round goes through. Don't hear my name called. So at this point, I'm just like, fuck. Like,
yeah, what was that? What was the take us into that mindset? What did your agent say at this point? Like, did panic set in, or like, you know, how was it?
Yeah. Panic definitely set in for me. Like, I was all over the place. Like, I was calling him 100 times, like, what's going on? I thought this team needed a back. I thought this team really liked me. And, you know, at that point, there's not really much my agent can do.
Yeah. But like, I mean, going into the day, like, where did you think you're going to go?
Mm-hmm. Truthfully, I held my breath and I held out hope that I could be a first round pick. I knew that it probably wasn't going to happen, but I was like, let me just turn the first round on. Let me sit here. If it happens, it happens. Now, again, I didn't expect it to happen because my draft party that I had was planned for day two.
Right.
So, you know, I truly wasn't expecting, but I still held out hope until they said the 32nd pick. And I was like, please, like, come on, please. But didn't happen. So then day two starts and I'm thinking, okay, today's showtime. Like, it's not going to be long that I'm going to have to wait. They're going to call my name pretty early in the second round. And like I said, they went through the whole second round calling name after name. There were some other running backs that got drafted. And by that point, I was just like, fuck it. Like, I'm going to just cancel the party. Like, everybody just go home. Like, I'll find out when I get drafted and I'll just, you know, sit here and be mad that I get drafted. But again, I had that same thought that I had had, you know, many other times in my career where it's like, listen, I'm going to get drafted. Yes, yeah, sir. Here we go. I'm going to get drafted. My time is going to come. All they're doing is pulling the arrow back further and further and further, and it's just going to shoot me that much more forward. So crazy thing that actually happened to break all this up was the Tennessee Titans called me. And they were like, hey, we've got a couple picks coming up, or we got a pick coming up in the next couple picks. We're thinking about taking you. Like, you know, how would you feel about being a Titan and everything? And I was like, shit, that's great. Like, go play with Derek again. You know, hopefully it won't be like the he takes all the reps and I take none. But you know, I get to play with my dog again, and, you know, I'll be close to home. And, you know, that'll be cool, right? So then right before the pick, the Titans had a pick. I guess the Patriots had a pick. And then I get a call from a Foxborough number, and I'm like, oh, this is weird. And so I answer, and he's like, you know, this is Bill Belichick. How did you feel about being a Patriot? Like, does that sound all right to you?
That sound all right to you.
I'm about to go to Tennessee, man.
I was like, fuck it. Sure, whatever. Sure, sounds man. Good to me. Oh, shit. And so, you know, I hung up the phone, and like, once I hung up the phone and I heard it on the TV, the New England Patriots pick is in, and I knew it was me. Like, at that moment, I finally just like put my head down, and then I feel like that's when everything really set in. And when I say everything set in, it was not the fact that I thought I was going to be a first round pick and I wasn't. It wasn't the fact that I thought I was going to be a second round pick and I wasn't. It was that kid that was 8 years old that didn't even want to play football, that literally wanted to rip my helmet off and quit. I hated getting tackled. I hated the helmets. I hated the grass. That same kid has had his name called and selected in the 2019 NFL draft.
True, man.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Like, wow. Wow, wow, wow. And I remember I just sat there and I cried. Yeah. And my mom was there. And, you know, I had a bunch of other people there. And, you know, everybody was cheering, everybody was clapping, everybody was happy. But like, I literally just sat there and just cried, because I was just like, man, like, I've been so worried about so much other shit that's like not really important. Because at the end of the day, as me being the 87th pick, I have the same exact opportunity afforded to me as the guy that got drafted number one. And all nice. That is a seat on the bus. Like, people, that's a saying for those out there that are listening. That's a saying that we say in football, and I'm sure in a lot of other sports. But all you want to do is have a seat on the bus. You just want to have a jersey to put on. You just want to have an opportunity to step on the field, because once you get that, your opportunity will come, and then it'll fall on you to make the most of that. And I was never worried. Whenever my opportunity comes, that shit's going to shake. Like, I'm going to make some shit pop. But at the end of the day, man, like I said, I just hung my head and just like felt all the stress roll off my back, and just all the greatness and the reward of all that hard work that I put in from age 8 to, I guess, what this would have been, 21, 22 years old. And, it just finally all paid off.
In fact, that's one of the things they were always preaching when we got to New England, was it doesn't matter how you got here. It's what matters, what you do when you're here in the building.
Amen.
And that's what you're going to be judged on, not where you came from or what your background is.
Nope.
That's real, man. Talk about this a little bit. So you get drafted to New England. Obviously, at the time, they were the reigning Super Bowl champs. Brady is still there. Julian Edelman, all of these big names. What was kind of like your expectation or what you thought the next few years were going to look like versus what it ended up being?
Shit, I thought that these was going to be Super Bowl rings, right? Listen, Mark, once I got done crying, I got a group of all my friends. We got in a Suburban. We drove to Lexington. Again, home of the Kentucky Wildcats. Sorry. But drove to Lexington, went to the bar, had us a grand old time. And I remember, like, standing in there. And a bunch of people, like, again, like, Kentucky, it's a medium-sized state, but it's pretty small in comparison to, like, I know this guy, I know that guy. Like, everybody knows each other. So whenever I got to the bar, you know, everybody's like, oh, shit, like, congrats. Like, da-da-da-da-da. Like, how are you feeling? I was like, yo, I'm about to win a fucking Super Bowl. Like, this is crazy. Like, I'm playing with Tom. I'm playing with Jules. Like, I'm playing for Bill. Like, it's going to be no different. Like, I'm going to come in. I'm going to win my Super Bowls, just like I went to Alabama, won my national championships. Like, dude, I was on cloud 9, right? And then, Mark, this is where it gets scary. I go to New England. same exact thing happens my rookie year that happened my freshman year at Alabama. I don't see the field. There was a guy by the name of Sony Michel that had got drafted the year before me. He was a first-round pick. And not only was he a first-round pick, he had a postseason, like a playoff season, that was one of the best in NFL history, like six rushing touchdowns in the playoffs, had scored the only touchdown in the Super Bowl that year. Like, so he was hot. Right. He was booming. And I came in, and it was like that feeling that I had said that I wanted to avoid, that feeling that I never wanted to feel again, like that shit came back. And so that was when I learned a hard lesson. And that hard lesson is when you feel like you've made it, when you feel like you have made it to the precipice of whatever it is that you want. And again, I'll go back to saying, like, this eight-year-old, going from the eight-year-old kid in small town Kentucky to being a draft pick by the New England Patriots, a team that has one of the most historic histories in the history of the NFL. They wanted me. I've been drafted. I've reached my goals of getting to the NFL, which 0.0000001% of people actually get to do. And here I am fucking sitting on the bench again as a non-motherfucking factor. Somebody who don't do nothing. I barely even played special teams. That's how bad they thought I was. I could barely even get a role on special teams. And it was just like a flat out, like, damn, am I really back at square one all over again? And that's what I just learned. Like I said, like, you can think that you made it all you want, but once you get that complacency, that feeling of I've made it, God, the elements, the sport, whoever, however it needs to happen, you will get humble. Right.
Quickly.
And very quickly and very suddenly and very realistically. Mm-hmm. And so all that time I spent in the bar talking about, like, oh, I'm going to win a Super Bowl. I'm about to do this. I'm about to do that. Well, guess what? My rookie year, I didn't play a lick. That was one of the worst seasons that the Patriots had and during, you know, Tom's 20 years there. Because, yeah, I don't know if you remember, we started out 8-0 and everybody thought we were going to go undefeated.
It was a good
time.
Win
the Super Bowl that year. I remember, I don't know if you remember when Jamie Collins had that pick six against the Dolphins in Miami.
I remember.
Yeah. I remember at that moment, I was like, listen, I might not play all year, but I'm still going to go to the Super Bowl.
I'm still getting the ring, baby.
There's something positive coming out of this. Then next thing you know, we started losing a couple straight. Then we ended up losing in the wild card. Like, Tom Brady's last throw at Gillette Stadium as a Patriot was a pick six against the Titans. Mm-hmm. And it was just like this storybook ending, I guess, for the beginning of my NFL career was a storybook disaster.
It went exactly
how I planned for it not to. And so what did I do? I took a little vacation. I reset my focus. And then I came back and I was just like, you know what it's time to do? It's time to fucking go to work. Oh, yeah. Like, that's all it's like. And the consistency with all of my stories, all of my experiences is when shit gets hard, when shit hits the fan, when shit starts going left or I start feeling like I'm being pulled back, my first thought is it's time to go to fucking work. And Yacht can attest to this because me, Yacht, there was another friend of ours named Gunner, phenomenal teammate, phenomenal friend. Shout out to you, Gun Show. Like, the three of us, we made the decision that we were not leaving Foxborough come hell or high water. We were going to stay there all offseason. We were going to train. We were going to let them run us into the fucking ground.
Yeah.
We were
nah, he told that story many times. Yes, sir.
Exactly. We were going to let them work us as hard and as long as they needed to because we were going to prove that we were worthy. We were going to prove that even when it looked like shit was starting to sink and the ship was starting to go down like the Titanic, we were going to be the motherfuckers that stayed there and tried to work and tried to bring that shit back up. And I would tell you, all of the success, all of the memorable moments that we had in the NFL, like Yacht pancaking motherfuckers, Yacht leading the way, clearing the way for me to score 15 touchdowns. Because again, I would not have had that season. Yacht knows that I feel this way wholeheartedly. I would have never had the success in New England that I did without Yacht. And I wouldn't have had that success if Yacht hadn't been as hard of a worker as he was, because he worked so hard that he put himself in a position to where I could count on him. Wherever the fuck Yacht went, I was right there behind him. Not only that, the way that he worked and trained in the offseason motivated me to work and train in the offseason. That way, when Sundays came, That way, whenever I was following him, he knew that I was equipped and that I would do right with whatever block he made, whichever angle, whichever path he took. He knew that I was going to do my job based off of him doing his job. Mm-hmm. Same with Gunner, even though he was a receiver and it was a little bit different for him as a punt returner. But at the end of the day, we leaned on each other. We depended on each other and we fucking worked like dogs because that's who we are.
100%. If there's good, one thing about I know about Jakob bad. Johnson, man. He's putting in that work.
Yeah, hey,
he putting in that work.
Listen, I want to tell y'all. Hey, this is when I knew Yak was for real. I remember there was one time, it was like in the off season, and we had just got done doing strength conditioning, all this stuff, and then he's like, Yak was the main, like he is the example of stay extra, stay after, do extra, do more, so on and so forth. And I remember asking him, like, yeah, bro, we work so much fucking harder than everybody else. Why are you still doing all this extra work? And he was like, I don't feel like I've hit my maximum for the day. And like where I come from, if I have not reached my full potential, if I have not done my full amount of work, I do not get to eat. You do not understand. I will not get to eat if I don't do the amount of work. If I don't run these hills, if I don't run as much as I need to, I will not get to eat.
Now you're switching to African accent, though. What is
it? Listen, that was real.
He's like, for you guys, this is a game. For me, this is my life. I need to eat water, and if I don't do enough, I can't do it. But
it's funny.
Dude, that shit motivated me. Like we can laugh about it now, but yo, that shit.
That shit made me so much better, but it goes both ways,
right? Because I mean, obviously, I came from a different situation, being an international guy, right? Just having to grind to get to that spot. Having Damien in those workouts with us, right? Even though he's the guy that they got drafted and the guy that they're looking at to be, you know what I mean, the featured back and everything, him being in those workouts with us, leading those runs, and then coming back really a changed player in that second year and becoming more of a leader of a team. And that was an inspiration to me, you know what I mean? Because I was like, oh man, you know, this guy's already more talented than me, and now he's working on the same level as I am. Like, I gotta keep it up. I think that trust above that, right?
Yeah,
you know, it kind of became like competitive on that sense, but in a positive way, because nobody wanted to let 100%. The other person down, right? Yep. We're all sacrificing, we're all putting so much into this that you just don't want to let your brother down, man. I think that's when special things can happen in a team, right? When you not only have, I mean, we're a small group, but if you can get a whole team together of guys who buy in on that level, I think that's where the magic really is in this 100%. Game.
Absolutely.
But okay, talk to me. Okay, 2020 season, y'all came back, new mindset, new, you know, workout level, reach, whatever. Like, how did that go?
Man.
That was Cam Newton's first year? Is that right?
Yeah, that COVID year, first COVID year. Shout out to Cam, man. Shout out to Cam.
Man, you know, those were some of the best times of my life, man. You know, scoring 15 touchdowns, or, you know, there was a year I was the highest graded back in the league based on, you know, what grading
PFF
service But depending on what you look at, what you actually care about. Some people like PFF, some people don't. Right. I don't really give a fuck. But at the end of the day, like, none of that compared to the time that we had as competitors and as teammates that during those off seasons. I remember, and it would get so competitive. It would get so feisty. Like, me and Gunner, so we would do, like, we would run, like, what were they, 80s or were they 60s on Fridays?
I think 60s, yeah. I want to say, yeah.
So we would do 60s, right? And at first, it started as, like, me and Gunner would just race on the very last rep. Then it got to the point where we were racing every single rep. And, like, we were putting our hamstrings at risk. We were putting our quads at risk. But we were just
And, Mark,
so
this is
better.
Really just the conditioning. This yeah, is really just
what
like,
time
hey, we're
we talking
20.
During the season now?
No, we're talking
about – Oh, we're talking off-season.
We're talking
okay,
about February.
I got you. Yeah.
We're talking about February.
Yeah. And I remember there was one time because Gunner's thing – I used to smoke Gunner every time we would run these bitches. But his favorite thing to say is that I would jump off sides, or I would false start, or I would start before they actually said go. My response was, I just got great reaction time. So it's like, as soon as he says go, motherfucker, I'm 5 yards ahead of you. Like, I don't know. Like, figure it out, right? But I remember there was one time we were running, and it was the very last rep. And him and I were hell-bent. This is probably the hardest him and I ever ran doing these sprints. And I smoked his ass. And I started doing laps around the indoor, just fucking yelling, all type of trash talk and this, that, and the third. And he looks at me, he goes, well, you know what? Your ass is going to be sitting on the bench if you keep jumping off sides. Your ass isn't even going to be on the field. So how can you even win if you're not on the field? And it was just like, it was so much chirping back and forth. But you know what happened? As soon as we got done talking shit, we sat down on the bench, took our cleats off, and we were like, man, we got some good fucking work in today. Like, yeah. We got better today. Mm-hmm. Like, we are going to be better because of how hard we pushed each other today. Our football team is going to be better. Now, like what Yach said about us coming and having a different season, but like stepping more into leadership roles, now we can have that voice in the locker room where we can be like, hey, if I see a guy not competing at the level that I'm competing at, I can say something to him about it, because at the end of the day, I stayed here through a Boston winter, through feet of snow, and I went up, I showed up every day, worked my ass off, and literally maxed myself out on every single rep. So not only did it make me a better player, it made me a better person, it made me a better leader, it made me more communicable with my teammates as far as speaking up and being able to use my voice. And like, those are the things, like, those are the moments that allowed, like I said, me to have really successful moments in my career. That's what allowed Gunner to be an first-team mm-hmm. all-pro punt returner. Mm-hmm. That's what allowed Yacht to be literally the next James Devlin, like his idol, his favorite football player ever. Like, for those of y'all who don't know, and I don't know how many people out there don't know this, this dude, Yacht, literally fractured his shoulder blade, knocking the shit out of a D lineman. Fractured his shoulder blade. And literally, Tom is asking him, like, yo, are you good? You need to go on. He's like, oh, no, I'm fine. I'm good. I'm all right. Finds out that he completely broke his shoulder blade and had to miss the rest of the season. But, like, you could not have drug Yacht off that field during that game in that moment, right? Like, and it again goes back to that, like, the jokes I was making about him not feeling like he had worked hard enough that day, or, you know, the evidence of how hard we actually worked to have those moments. Like, it was all the team building, and what's the word I'm looking for? Not your motor. It's like your work ethic.
Your drive.
Your drive, yeah. Things like that. Like, all that other shit, like, all the success is just a proponent of what we developed during those off seasons from the hard work, from the mentalities that we had. So to me, that's why those moments will always be so special, because there wouldn't have been 15 touchdowns without running bouts next to Yach, who is 60 pounds heavier than I am, but he's killing my ass on these runs, right? Like, there is no highest graded back without racing against Gunner every single time we had an 80-yard sprint and, like, trying to get to the finish line before him. There would have been no first team all pro for Gunner if he hadn't been chasing me the whole time. And again, Yach was kind of like the chemist of all of it, because he did have such an interesting journey and such an interesting route where he felt like he was already behind the eight ball, coming from a different country, feeling like, okay, maybe I'm not as, you know, just at, like, when it comes to just talent, as talented as these guys. So I have to show up and I've got to earn it every single fucking day. And then he taught me, somebody who had, you know, life pretty easy for the most part from high school after my freshman year of college, now I'm at a level where everybody's fucking good. So my own athletic ability, that gets me nothing anymore. Yacht taught me how to fucking work. Gunner taught me how to literally go out there and give my last breath. Like, football was my life. And, like, without it, I have no breath. Now, granted, I'm a 28-year-old retired football player who's got a wife and a son. So I know that there are things that are more important to football. But Gunner taught me how important it was to be able to give and sacrifice your body, your mind, your heart, your soul, your emotions, every limb in your body for the man next to you. Like, I learned so much from them. Hopefully, you know, I taught them some things in the process. But again, like, I just can't harp enough about how those moments where we, like, started to intertwine like this behind the scenes when the cameras weren't rolling, when we weren't playing on Sundays, that led to our eventual success and being able to, you know, have these kind of discussions and reflect on great careers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when you look back on it, like it's of course unfortunate that we didn't get to have the kind of success that ends up turning into championship rings, right? Like various reasons that or a lot of things that play into that. But what I think made that so special is that we can all look back on those years without regret, because you know that you put your all into it. Gunnar knows that. For me, the same thing. We left it all out there. And at the end of the day, that's why they brought us in the building. That's why they kept us around for the years that we were there. And, you know, that allows you to have your head held up high, even though you might not have the rings to show for it, is that you honor that moment and approach it the right way.
Yeah, no, like I definitely, like, you know, I had heard something at one point in time, and I might be butchering the quote here, so don't quote me exactly, but a man once said that the only difference between success and failure is how people look at you. And I never really understood that. I was like, well, that makes no fucking sense whatsoever. Like, how does that even correlate? How does that even translate? Well, my best chance at trying to break that down and understand that is the moments that we're talking about right now. Like, granted, we never won a Super Bowl. Granted, we never won a playoff game. Yacht just said it perfectly. We have no regrets. We left no stone unturned. We did absolutely everything that we could have to get us to where we wanted to go. And as somebody who's sitting here with national championship rings on my finger, I feel just as proud of the effort that I put in to not winning Super Bowls and not winning playoff games as I did putting in effort being a part of championship teams. The only difference is some people in college, when it comes to college, people see me as a champion. When people see me in the NFL, they see me as like, oh, he was a guy that had a couple of good seasons. But at the end of the day, I was always the motherfucker that just worked my ass off and did everything I could to be my best version of myself. That way I can make the offense the best version of themselves. That way we could be the best team that we could possibly be. At Alabama, that helped us win championships. In New England, unfortunately, it did not. But at the end of the day, I have the same level of pride in my performance, in my execution, in my work ethic, in my drive and determination as I did when I won those national championships. So to me, I don't know if that makes sense to y'all, but I mean, maybe that's what Buddy means when he says success and failure is pretty much the same. The only difference is how people get you.
No, that's true.
Regardless, you can win championships without putting in any effort whatsoever. You can lose without putting in any effort whatsoever. You can win by putting in a shit ton of effort. You can lose while putting in a shit ton of effort. Like, all of that, the championships, the trophies, you know, the nickname champion, that's just shit that's given to you by the outside world. There's people that aren't inside of what you're doing giving you a name, giving you a title. Obviously, you earn it, but at the end of the day, like, just because we didn't win in New England doesn't take away how hard we fought to get to where we wanted to go. So, like I said, at the end of the day, I got the same amount of pride and the same amount of happiness, you know, as I did at Alabama, because again, I can still come away with it knowing that I gave my best, with stories like everything that we've been talking about, with how, you know, hard work and work ethic and mentality brought me, Gunnar, and Yacht to be three of the best friends. Like, those are the two best friends I could ever ask for. Like, those are going to be my fucking brothers for life. You know what I mean? I'm waiting any day for Yacht to call me and tell me that he's had his baby. You know what I mean? So
I love it, man.
This is what football, this is what sports, this is what working hard, having goals and doing anything to achieve them. Like, it brings you so many other things other than just trophies and money and shit like that.
Facts. Hey, Yacht, real quick. Or do you have anything else? I kind of want to.
I would have went just to the end a little bit, right? Like, you had your days in New England. You ended up with the Buffalo Bills. You're definitely a guy that, like you said, puts it all out there. Football was your life for those years. Talk a little bit about kind of the end of your career and what kind of gave you those signals that it might be time to move on to the next chapter.
Yeah. Wow. So that was a time for sure. You know, my career was cut short due to a neck injury when I was in Buffalo, and it was super scary. Like, it was exactly what your worst fear is as a football player. You have a neck injury. My whole body was numb. I was carried off on a stretcher. They put me in an ambulance. They took me to a hospital. You know, my wife was running through the stadium like a chicken with her head cut off because, you know, she didn't know what was going on. All she had seen was that I was hurt. And then by the time she got to the next place where she could actually see the field. Then she saw the ambulance and she was like, wait, what the fuck? Why is there an ambulance? Like, I have no idea what was going on. Mind you, she was, I want to say 7 months. No. 5 months pregnant at the time. Oh, so boy. Yeah, it was really tough. It was really scary. And, you know, I'm a very spiritual person and I felt like I was at a point in time in my life where I was starting to question a lot of things, like not if I wanted to continue to play football, but more so like, was I happy with the environment that I was in? Was I happy with the role that I was in? Now, at that point, I was on a 1-year deal. So I knew like after that season, I would have opportunities to, you know, go somewhere else, make a better opportunity for myself, make a better name in the second part of my career. But I was just so unsure of like what the rest of the season was going to look like. Is my playing time going to get upped? Is this going to happen? Is this going to happen? Am I finally going to get my spot? And then it was like when I was asking God all these questions and trying to figure out so many things and asking him for signs, asking for him to guide me, asking him for show me the way, literally he presented it right in front of me by putting me on a stretcher and, you know, having me taken off in an ambulance to the hospital and get my neck looked at. And it was crazy because, you know, in such a hectic moment, like once everything kind of cleared and like once I was in the ambulance and we were driving, I could tell we were on our way to the hospital. There was such a quiet moment where I felt like me and God were having a talk with ourselves to where he asked me, do you see what I am showing you? Do you hear what I am saying to you? Do you feel what I'm trying to get you to feel? And I was finally just like, I understand. I see it. I hear it. I feel it.
And I think there's power that like this tracks with your story from the beginning, right? From your first moment when it clicked for you to, I got to actually put the work in. I got to see this through with football when you had to talk with your mom to the decision to go to Alabama, following your intuition, following your conversation with God to that moment where it's like, okay, I'm trying to show you something. I'm trying to tell you something and being able to listen to that.
Yeah, no, it was, you know, I always try to be a faith-driven person. And, you know, I understand that nothing is possible without the help of the Lord. So, you know, good, bad, indifferent, like the Lord has a plan for all of us. He has a plan for this earth. He has a plan for this world. And, you know, we are all just living testaments. We're just walking the path that he set for us. And like I said, with that, you know, with that belief that I've always had, with that faith that I've always had, like, I try not to question God. I really do. And it was just something about that moment that, you know, his presence was so, like, you know, I talked about him wanting to feel his presence. Like, it's almost like he was right there in the ambulance with me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Talking with me, holding my hands, guiding me, saying it's all good. Saying, and not even just for me, for my wife, you know, because she was in the front seat of the ambulance and she had no idea what was happening, what was going on. And, you know, he was able to comfort her and obviously protect her, protect our son, you know, all of these things. And, you know, it was such a sign. Like, I can't really credit it to anything other than that of just like, you know, sometimes things are taken away from you, but you don't understand that it's only because something bigger, better, more important is about to be placed in front of you. And for me, that was my son.
Right.
Like, I can't even, you know, I was telling my wife the other day, I wasn't telling my wife. I was actually telling one of my friends that is about to get engaged to his girlfriend. And he was talking about all that. And I just told him, I was like, man, there is absolutely nothing that as an individual I could have ever accomplished. Super Bowl, Hall of Fame, first team All Pro. There's nothing that I could have accomplished as an individual that would have brought me more gratitude and made me feel like a better man than what my family brings me, what the love of a good 100%. Woman brings me, what the love of a son, a healthy son, a beautiful son that just like they do things for me. The things that I will do with them and accomplish with them will far supersede anything that I could have done as an individual. That's the point of having a family, because together you have more. When you're an individual, all that individual success, even when you reach the mountaintop, because granted, there's certain mountaintops I didn't reach, but there were a lot of mountaintops that I did. And I can tell you, going in and waking my son up every single morning and seeing the smile on his face is greater than anything that I've ever done single-handedly. So God knew that God knew that I would appreciate how much I was going to appreciate my family, how much it was going to mean to me to be a son. And he just took the game of football away from me. That way I could spend more time being an active, present father.
Which you're doing an excellent job at, by the way.
Thank
like,
you.
I don't know if you guys are following Damien. Like, this is definitely a candidate for dad of the year every year.
Well, I'm glad that you said this because I was going to say transparently, like, my father wasn't around for my life at all. Like, I've met my father one time. And that's the same amount of times that I've talked to him. And, you know, all my life, I wasn't sitting around thinking like, man, I can't wait to be a dad. But I did always say, man, I can't wait to be a damn good dad. I can't wait to be a great fucking dad.
I love that, man.
You know, the actual fatherhood part can wait. But once I'm there, like, I can't wait to be a great father. So, again, like, God just removed something that was so important to me, something that I love so much, and something that I thought was really one of my main purposes in life, and showed me this is nothing in comparison to what I'm about to give you, what I'm about to allow you to enjoy. And, you know, it was just that. Like I said, I try not to question God, but, you know, I did try. I tried my hardest to get myself back in shape to play again and get to where I needed to be an NFL and the running or a running back in the NFL. But I medically got disqualified and, you know, I saw two doctors. I saw the first one. He told me I couldn't play anymore. I was like, nah, I'm going to go see another one.
We're going to find a different doctor. Yeah. You might not have went to the right med school.
Yeah, like, right. That's why in the NFL, they let you get second opinions all the time. Yeah. I was like, I'm going to get a second opinion. Not the same doctor, but another doctor told me the same thing. And I was like, damn, like, this is really over. And as soon as I left that doctor's appointment, I came home like I would any other day, and my fucking son just ran up to me, gave me a big old hug, was smiling. I got to play with him, and I was just like, again, that was my second time. The first time was in the ambulance, but the second time I was just like, all right, God, I hear you. I feel you. You are with me every step of the way. You are guiding me, and you are putting things in front of me that need to be in front of me, and you are taking things that don't need to be in front of me, and then you are putting them behind me and telling me to leave them in the past.
Yeah, how you feel now? Like, you at peace with it?
Oh my God. There's nothing I love more than being a fucking husband and a fucking dad.
Yeah.
Like,
hey, Mark, I'm telling you, you gotta see this guy. First of all, the setup, he's out there, nice house, you know what I mean? In the good suburbs, you know what I mean? And then kitchen, you know what I mean?
Where's home now? Cooking. You still back in Kentucky or where?
Nah, so I live in Georgia. I live in the suburbs of
Georgia. Gotcha. Dude, close to Atlanta.
I'm full-time dad and husband.
I mean, that's what I do. You man, you're
cooking,
trying to make me.
I'm cooking. Yeah, listen, man. I'm cooking all the meals for my wife. Like, listen, my wife has not cooked one time since we started dating. I cook all
that's man. That's okay, a good that's man different. Right there. Yeah. That's a good man, Savannah.
Dude, I change all my son's diapers. Unless I'm cooking, that's the only time I will not step away and change diapers.
Good hygiene. Love that.
Yeah, you know, like taking my, you know, one thing that I love doing is, you know, taking my son to all these like little social classes where he's learning things, he's learning all his motor skills, he's learning music classes.
Ooh, yeah,
sensory.
How old is he now?
You know, he's 11 months.
Okay,
be
nice.
One,
yeah. So I got a nine-month-old daughter. I got two older boys, I feel you.
And like, listen, Mark, can you name me something better than being a fucking dad?
Absolutely not. Especially that first time around.
You will experience it soon.
The first time, man, that is a special moment, man. Nothing like it.
There's nothing in the world like it, dude. So all of that long-windedly to say, dude, I could not be more at peace. And the best part about being at peace for me is what brings me so much peace is I feel like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Like there's something so magical, which again, and I know this isn't a religion podcast, and so I'm not out here
trying to promote,
you know, religion on anybody, but whether it's God, whether it's some form of higher power, whether it's just the energy in the world that you believe in, like there is something so magical and something so captivating about feeling like you are exactly where God wants you to be. You are exactly where the world has you meant to be. Like you are in the perfect situation. Now, I'm not saying every day is easy. I'm not saying I don't still deal with, you know, struggles of having an 11-month-old. Like shit, this month he'd be trying to rip his diaper off every chance he gets. Like, he's going through a developmental phase where now all of a sudden he thinks he don't need naps anymore and he can just scream and hoot and holler at everybody. Like, I'm not by no means trying to sit here and say I live a perfect life and my life is just easy and it's peaches and cream all day, every day. But I find just so much peace and happiness and figuring out that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Every struggle that I'm going through or that I have to go through, I'm supposed to go through that because the person that's on the other side of that struggle is going to be 10 times stronger. Every class that I take my son to, I'm supposed to be taking him there. I'm supposed to be here cooking, doing for my wife. I'm supposed to be not playing football, but you know, being a college football, NFL football analyst, that way I can try to bridge the gap between your average listener and what actually happens in the game. Like, I'm not supposed to be playing football because I'm supposed to be out in the community setting a good example of how to be a good member of society, how to raise a good young man. Now I don't have to be traveling on weekends or traveling on Thursdays, traveling this day. I can spend more time with my son. I can teach him how to be a proper man in society, how to respect his mother, how to treat his mother, how to treat other women, how to treat other people, how to treat people of different races, different ethnicities, different beliefs that come from different backgrounds that like different things. Like, that is what I'm here to do. Like, football served its purpose in my life as far as me playing the game. Now there are so many other great things that I've learned, so many other great attributes that I have picked up on along those times that now I just want to give back. Like, all the knowledge, all the experience, all the things that I've created for myself, I want to help. I want to spread my right arm and touch somebody. I want to spread my left arm and touch somebody. And the people that I touch, I want to you know, make them do the same, encourage them. That's the word I'm looking for. I want to encourage them to do the same, because if they do that, if everybody just reaches their arms out like this and just touches one another and just holds one another, like people and like human beings that we all are, like the reach that we have, the goodness that we can spread, it becomes so much further. It becomes so much easier when we're all connected and holding hands as humans and people on this earth. So,
man, that's so real.
I couldn't
that's
be at so more real. Peace, Mark. I couldn't love be it, at man. More peace.
Man, you're gonna make me tear up in here, man. But this is no, because it's so beautiful. You on the one hand, life, God, the universe taking something away from you, but really not taking something away from you, but making space for what's next, right? And then you filling that space with all the tools, all the lessons, everything that you picked up along your journey to give to everybody else. I think that's what me and Mark are trying to do with this podcast. I see that's what you're doing with your analyst work and everything that you're doing, man. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Listen, y'all, keep doing it, because again, I will say this world needs it. This world needs more people like us that don't care what you look like, don't care who you like, what you like, where you came from, who you praise, who you believe in. It's all about just trying to make life as beautiful and as respectful and as safe of a space for the human being next to me and the human being next to Yach and the human being next to Mark as we possibly can. Because as people, we all we got. All I got, like right now, like closest to me in proximity, all I have is my wife and son. But once I step outside in the real world, all we've got are other people and the decisions that they choose to make. It's no different than like when you're driving a car. People always talk about, oh, well, be careful when you're driving. Like, don't be a distracted driver. Well, a lot of times accidents happen because of the actions of other people. You know what I mean? Like, we all have to be like this when it comes to the sake of humanity and the sake of people. Regardless of what they look like, what they believe in, where they came from. Just because, again, when I step out of here with my family, I'm basically at the mercy of somebody else's actions. Like, I can do my best to protect us and drive safe and make sure I strap my son in the car seat, make sure my wife's wearing her seatbelt. But at the end of the day, if somebody decides to drive under the influence, like, we can do all the right things and still have a negative outcome because of the actions and decisions of somebody else. People don't realize that. And that's why people are so divisive right now. And that's just encouraging more turmoil. But when we look at it as in, okay, how my safety, my safe space, everything good that I believe in, like, that all is dependent on the person, somebody else's, you know, determination to be a good person or to be, you know, have a good heart and things like that. Like, you are at their mercy. Like, this safe space that we have in these walls, like, if somebody decides to come in here, then guess what? It's not a safe space anymore. But that's why we all as humans just need to have good in our hearts, leave the prejudice behind us, move that move that space, create space for love, remove time, space, and energy for anything that is divisive.
Hey, Dame, I got to tell you, man. Hey, I mean, we met about an hour ago, but like from my bottom of my heart, man, that's probably one of the realest conversations I had in my life. I mean, just honestly, appreciate you opening up, sharing with us, man, your perspective, talking about purpose.
I think we could be on here.
That's what I'm saying. I could listen to you all day, man. Like, just honestly, the lessons in life and like the journey you've been through and the lessons you took from all this stuff you've been through, the ups and the downs, and just like sharing the perspective. I think there's a lot of people out there who'll be able to like take something from that and apply it to their own life. So that's huge. So I appreciate you sharing
That's what I hope, man. I just hope there have been so many great people in my life that, you know, have touched my life in this way or given me good perspective that like I'm at a place in my life where that's all I want to do.
For right.
Like I just want to be like, I spend a lot of my time being selfish and focused on, you know, how I can make myself better, how I can get to this mountaintop, well, now I'm about how can I do for my wife, my son, for the person that lives next door, my great neighbors, people live across the street from me, person who I don't know from a can of paint, but at the end of the day, like if I can do something, leave them with something that can make them smile. Like I'm always telling jokes to whenever I go in like a gas station or a convenience store or Target or something like that. Like I'll leave somebody with a dad joke just because like you'd be surprised, Mark, at how many times I've gone into a store and like just made the cashier laugh for no reason. And they've been like, man, I need
it. Right, man. Yeah, that's real. Mm. Facts.
You know 100%. What I mean? And you never know. Mm-hmm. You never know. So hopefully the people can take something out of all this shit that I've been saying.
Yeah,
no, that's real. Hey, soll ich nach Hause bringen? All right. Damien, I'm going to do this outro in German, but I only have nice things to say about you. Thank you for taking the time today. To come in here sharing your story, being so open, being so vulnerable. Like you said, I think there's actually a lot in these last 90 minutes that people can take something away from. Auf Deutsch, danke für alle, die diese Episode dabei waren. Game Changers. Wir haben eine Woche Pause gemacht, aber wir sind zurückgekommen mit Feuer und wir haben noch viel mehr Feuer geplant für euch die nächsten Wochen. Findet Damien auf Social Media. Das ist echt ein sehr, sehr guter Mann mit einer starken Message. Und wir hören uns beim nächsten Mal. Bis dahin. Peace.